Hello, this is Chair Mike Freiberg. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote hearing of the Preventive Health Committee to order. The clerk will take the roll for attendance for quorum.
Representative Freiberg.
Here.
Representative Bierman.
Present.
Representative Grunhagen.
Present.
Representative Akam.
Present.
Representative Egbaje.
Present.
Representative Ackland.
Present.
Representative Carlson.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Heinzman.
Present.
Representative Morrison. Representative Morrison. Representative Pryor. Representative Pryor. Chair, you have a quorum.
Sorry, the first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes of our January 13th meeting. Members should note there was a typo corrected, I think, and then an updated version was sent out and posted to the committee website as well. So I would anyone like to make a motion to approve the minutes?
Motion to approve.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative Bierman moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
You can unmute yourself to do that. Opposed? The minutes are approved. For this hearing, since we'll be discussing the public health impact of climate change, we've invited the members of the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee to be present. I think maybe just Chair Long would I'll just turn it over to you briefly if you'd like to say a few words just to kind of get the ball rolling here.
Thank you so much, Chair Freiberg. Really appreciate the invitation. And I think this is a really unique hearing. I'm not aware of a climate hearing in a health committee that's been done in the legislature before. So I congratulate you and thank you for pulling together this topic. And just briefly, I'll note that the American Public Health Association has said it's hard to overstate the interconnections between climate change, health, and equity. And I personally believe that climate change is the biggest public health crisis that is facing our nation and our world. So I think it's very appropriate for this committee to be hearing on this topic. And I just read the news last night that President Biden is creating an Office of Health and Climate Equity at the Health and Human Services Department. So this is something that the federal government is going to be very focused on as well going forward. So I think the topic is very timely and appropriate, and I'm grateful for you inviting our committee members to join you for the hearing today.
Thank you, Chair Long. And I did see a few other members of your committee who are here. I thought I might just give them the opportunity to say who they are and say hello. If anyone would like to do that who's not normally at the Preventive Health Policy Division meetings, please just say hello so we know you're here.
Chair Robert. Sorry, Robert Bierman. I'm on both committees, but
Okay.
Tie-in is obvious. Thank you.
Sure. Representative Christensen, I saw you.
Hi, I'm Shelley Christensen. I represent the Stillwater area, and I'm happy and excited to hear what we have today. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Stevenson, I think I saw you unmute yourself.
Yeah, thanks, Chair Freiberg. I'm on the Climate Committee. Thrilled that you're having this hearing and excited to see how things go.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Is there anyone, I think that's everyone just looking through that's not on this committee?
Chair Freiberg. Yeah, Representative Todd Lippert here as well, and I'm also on the Energy and Climate Committee, and really excited for this conversation today.
Yeah, thank you for being here.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this is Representative Jeremy Munson. I'm also on the Energy Committee.
Yep, thank you for being here, Representative Munson. Anybody I've missed? Okay. So we have several excellent testifiers lined up. So I think what I'm going to do, They all know, I think, how long they're scheduled to speak here, but I want to make sure they all get an opportunity to speak. But there should be, we've scheduled things so that there should be plenty of time for member discussion as well. So I'm going to ask members just to hold questions until the end. And and then we will call on members at that point. So with that, I'm going to, our first presenter is Kristen Robb.
Great. Good morning, Mr. Chair Freiberg and Mr. Chair Long. I'm Kristen Robb, the Director of the Minnesota Climate and Health Program at the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about climate and health impacts. I am going to share my screen right now. Hopefully this will come up just fine. Here we go. So this topic is near and dear to my heart, and it really affects all of us, but it does definitely affect some people more than others. Climate change has been called the great amplifier because it amplifies all kinds of climate-related issues and disasters, including heat waves and extreme precipitation events. And it also amplifies the resulting impacts of those extreme events so that they continue to perpetuate and increase health disparities in our communities. So during my very short time today, I hope to shed some light on some of those health impacts. And I'm also hoping that my colleagues that will be presenting afterwards will be sharing some meaningful examples of how these health impacts manifest in their lives and in their work. Sometimes it can be challenging to see how something so abstract like climate change can impact our health here in Minnesota. So we use this diagram to better describe how climate and health are linked. So starting at the top of the graphic and then just moving down, the release of greenhouse gases into our atmosphere changes the atmosphere's composition. This leads to two major changes in Minnesota. So that's first an increase in the temperature. We're increasing by 0.5 degrees Fahrenheit per decade. This may not seem like a significant change, but Minneapolis is 14th and Duluth is 16th, fastest warming cities in the U.S. The second major change is in precipitation. Minnesota's average precipitation is increasing by 0.5 inches per decade since 1960. These climatic changes lead to measurable alterations in our air, weather, water, and ecosystem patterns, which in turn leads to air quality, extreme heat, flooding, droughts, and ecosystems changes. And all of these impact our health. Increasing temperatures have extended our growing season, but more specifically, it has increased the allergenic ragweed pollen season by 15 to 25 days in and around Minnesota. This causes more acute respiratory issues such as allergies and asthma. Increasing temperatures may also lead to increases in extreme heat events or heat waves. Although the summer, last summer was relatively mild, in 2011, we had 6 days when the heat index was 108 degrees or higher, and we had 1,255 emergency department visits and 3 deaths due to heat. Precipitation isn't falling in a nice smooth blanket across much of our state. Most of this precipitation is falling as extreme rain events, so that some parts of our state are flooding and other parts of our state are in drought. Just for some perspective, we've experienced 18 historic mega rain events since 1858. And a mega rain event is declared when 6 inches of rain covers more than 1,000 square miles. So that's the size of Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington counties combined. Over this 160-year period, 10 of these 18 events, so more than half, have occurred since 2002, so within the last 20 years. These mega rain events are linked to significant localized flooding, which has health implications such as physical safety, waterborne diseases, and exposure to mold and flooded basements. So here's a picture of a recreational field in Moose Lake before and then after in the June 2012 extreme rainfall event. Between 7 and 11 inches fell in just 2 days in the areas around Duluth. This is just a flooded soccer field, but the impacts extended well beyond to public infrastructure damages, including roads, bridges, water and sewer systems, electricity, and communications infrastructures that exceeded $108 million. More than 1,700 homes and 100 businesses were damaged. The loss of a business, major home damage, financial stress can all lead to anxiety and other mental health issues. Finally, these changes in temperature and precipitation change our ecosystems, which may favor certain pests, such as ticks, that enjoy heat and humidity. This can lead to increases in vector-borne diseases, tick diseases like Lyme disease. In 2018, there were 950 confirmed Lyme disease cases in Minnesota. Climate change also poses threats to species that are important to our identity, such as our state grain like wild rice, and northern forest species such as birch trees, moose, and cold water fish. As these cultural species decrease and migrate north to find more suitable habitat, important cultural species that once provided identity, solace, sport, food, and traditions will be gone. So there is a lot at stake to not take immediate action on climate change mitigation and adaptation. We can turn the threat of climate change into an opportunity by investing in innovative, earth-protective policies and programs that support clean jobs, cleaner air, and create more healthy and equitable communities. Thank you.
You were right at the 6 minutes we had allocated for you, so thank you. Next, we have Teddy Porter.
I need to have Kristen turn off your share. Thank you.
Just please identify yourself to begin with and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg and Chair Long, for inviting me to speak today. My name is Teddy Potter, and I'm Director of Planetary Health for the School of Nursing at the University of Minnesota. And even though I've been invited to speak about the global impact of climate change on health, as you see in this lower corner, it doesn't take time before global becomes local. And those lines between global and local are very blurred. SARS-CoV-2 has shown us that a novel infectious disease can hop a plane and impact another part of the globe in a matter of hours. We can no longer dismiss global events because they're not local. Another example is Hurricane Maria, and it shows our interdependence. When Hurricane Maria destroyed much of Puerto Rico in 2017, hospitals in Minnesota were impacted by decreased access to IV bags and other necessary medical supplies that are manufactured on the island. And it's not just climate change. These are all the other ways that our environment is being degraded. And so it's important to understand that humans are causing disruptions of Earth's natural systems. And all of those impacts that we're having on the life support systems of our planet are being lived out in real health impacts today, such as cardiovascular diseases, respiratory diseases, antimicrobial diseases, certainly pandemics that we're seeing, mental health impacts, and other impacts. So what does this say about us today? Why am I here? This is a quote from the Lancet Countdown. They publish a report every year on the health impacts of climate change, and this was from their executive report in 2019. The life of every child born today will be profoundly affected by climate change, with populations around the world increasingly facing extremes of weather, food, and water insecurity, changing patterns of infectious disease, and a less certain future. Without accelerated intervention, this new era will come to define the health of people at every stage of their lives. Think about the children in your life, your children, your grandchildren, your neighbor children, children in your places of faith, children of your constituents. This is the future that we are going to doom them to unless we take rapid action. Also, we know that there's global impact on this. Between 2030 and 2050, climate change is expected to cause approximately 250,000 additional deaths per year related to malnutrition, malaria, diarrhea, and heat stress alone. And this has significant impacts also on economic measures. So I want to dig a little deeper into three particular examples. One is going to be related to climate change contributed a massive decline in biodiversity. In fact, the current rate of extinction is 1,000 times the normal rate of extinction. According to the World Health Organization, loss of habitat and biodiversity due to climate change will shift the distribution of plants, pathogens, animals, and even humans, predisposing us to future zoonotic diseases and pandemics. Harvard scientists have also studied the impact of elevated CO2 on the nutritional value of major grains, and they estimate that an elevated CO2 could cause an additional 175 million people to be zinc deficient and an additional 122 million people to be protein deficient, putting global populations at risk for malnutrition and impaired immunity. And each year, climate-related extreme weather events result in acute humanitarian crises. According to the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center, there were 18.8 million disaster-related internal displacements recorded in 2017. Displacement across borders also occurs and may be connected with conflict, violence, and war. But despite all this, there is hope. Planetary health requires us to do massive cross-sector transformation in how we do everything. And that opens us to innovation and collaboration. There are amazing possibilities here for the state of Minnesota, for our businesses, for our people. And so this is a time of a call to action, but also a time that has tremendous possibilities. So there's no doubt in my mind that Minnesotans can have the skills and the creativity to light the way to a healthier future for the rest of the globe. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Potter, and I apologize for getting your name wrong initially.
No problem.
Yep. Next on the list, I have Dr. Niasha Spears.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
All right, great. Thank you.
Please
so much.
Identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me. My name is Niasha Spears. I'm a family physician in at St. Luke's Hospital in Duluth, Minnesota. And I'm here not as a climate scientist. I'm here because I take care of people, and I'm concerned about my observations over the course of the last 2 decades. So I graduated from the University of Minnesota in 2001, and I've been practicing full-spectrum family medicine in Duluth, and I spent 10 years in Ashland, Wisconsin, which is on the south shore of Lake Superior, 70 miles east of here. But in my practice, I care for people of all ages, and I do obstetrical care, and I care for pediatrics, and I care for people all through the all stages of their life, sort of from practice from cradle to grave, as we like to say. So over the last 20 years, I have observed changes that should be recognized as harbingers of what is to come. And I want to share some of those observations that I think should grab our focus. They're the canaries in the coal mine, if you will. When I started my career, it was very interesting. I worked with Johann Bakken, for anyone who knows infectious disease. He's quite well known. And it was very interesting to get a case of human ehrlichiosis or Lyme disease. So you would get a case of Lyme disease and you'd run down the hallway to tell your partners, oh, hey, I got this Lyme disease. I've got a rash that may be Lyme's. Come look at this. That's no longer the case. Now in summer months, it is not unusual to see several cases of Lyme disease every month, sometimes every week. And very strikingly, this year in November, I removed a deer tick from a seven-year-old who had been, like the rest of us, confined to his home. He'd been playing only in his yard. And so I removed a deer tick from the back of his head. And 10 days later, he had erythema migrans, which is the hallmark rash of Lyme disease. And for those of you that are not medical or don't spend a lot of time in the woods, this is weird. It's hard to argue that a seven-year-old getting Lyme disease in northern Minnesota in November is not related to climate. We can monitor these vector-borne illnesses and mosquito and tick seasons lengthen. But we do not want to wait for dengue fever or Zika or malaria to march north before we act. This is truly one of our canaries sitting in the coal mine. I also, when I started practice 20 years ago, I certainly treated people for allergy. I mean, I'm a family doctor. This is part of what we do, and this is not strange. But we would treat people for 4 to 6 weeks during the ragweed season. You know, we'd use a little over-the-counter antihistamine or maybe some nasal spray. But now it is not uncommon at all to be treating people with like two drug regimens for 8 or 9 months or all year round to manage allergy symptoms. And it's not just asthmatics. It's people with asthma where this is exacerbating the asthma, but it's other people who are having to be on two drugs consistently through the year. And this is not the way it's always been. The other thing that I notice in my practice is a marked increase in anxiety surrounding big storm events. When I started in my career, people talked about the weather. This is Minnesota. This is what we do. We talk about weather. Big storms were scary and they were noteworthy. But now people have real anxiety about storm predictions. And the last few years have brought these huge storms that have disrupted our lives, you know, washed away roads, washed away our beloved lake walk here in Duluth. And the big blowdown that occurred 2 years ago took down vast numbers of large, healthy trees. And when our foundational parts of our environment, like the Duluth Lake Walk or large 200-year-old white pines in our yard, disappear overnight, this is foundationally disruptive. And the anxiety really starts to mount. And it's very, so what I'm seeing is people start getting anxiety when the storm clouds start to amass. And it's difficult to measure. We know that chronic anxiety increases cortisol levels. That's our fight or flight hormone, which damages blood vessels over time, which causes heart disease and causes strokes. But it's very difficult to say that stroke or that heart attack was because of climate change. But we know that this is what happens. This is another
probably wrap up pretty quickly.
I'm sorry. Okay. So we have a lot of canaries that are signaling us that we must take climate change very seriously in every aspect of our lives. And climate change will shape the health of every child born today. We can't wait until our state burns or floods. And we can't wait until we start caring for the Zika babies and their lifelong disabilities. These harms are insidious, and certainly in human health, they add up and are very often irreversible. And we need action. We need boots on the ground in every sector of society to reduce emissions and develop resilient communities. So sorry if I took more than my time. I appreciate the time to talk. And so thank you.
Thank you. It's very helpful getting examples from a practitioner, and I apologize for having to rush you there at the end. So next up is Zeke McKinney, and after Zeke will be Philip Peterson. So Mr. McKinney, just please identify yourself for the testimony, for the record, and then proceed with your testimony.
Yes, hello. Thank you for having me. My name is Zeke McKinney. I'm a physician and researcher at Health Partners, as well as a faculty within the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. My medical specialty of occupational and environmental medicine is not very well known, but focuses on environmental hazards. I'm African American. I grew up in North Minneapolis, and I'm currently a resident of Northeast Minneapolis near the Lowry Bridge. I'm in the Minnesota House District 60A and U.S. House District 5. So I'm here to discuss the impacts of climate on Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities, otherwise known as BIPOC communities. Let me start by telling you about social determinants of health, which are the social, economic, and physical conditions that impact health, functioning, and quality of life, and which include things like economic stability, education, health and health care, social and community context, and most relevant to this, probably the neighborhood and built environment. It has been demonstrated in an immense amount of medical literature that climate events compound societal and health disparities already found throughout the United States and worldwide. Here in Minnesota, we know we have greater social and health disparities than most other places in the United States, which occurs not because our BIPOC communities are doing worse on these indicators than elsewhere, but rather because our white communities have been doing so much better. So we have to consider why we have not been as successful in improving the social and health indicators of all our communities equally. So here are some reasons why this is also impacted by climate change and consequent extreme weather events such as heat waves, storms, and floods described by others today. Number one, BIPOC communities are already vulnerable in terms of economics, housing, food, and energy. So as a consequence, they are much more vulnerable when the environmental threats occur. Number two, areas more densely populated with BIPOC communities are most commonly already situated in areas with higher industrial use and consequently higher environmental contamination, and therefore are also more environmentally impacted when these crises occur, such as the more severe weather events that are occurring with worsening climate change. Number three, there are already degrees occurring of what would be called eco-gentrification, where lower income residents are being displaced by wealthier and usually white new residents with more green adaptations. This is problematic because there are more affluent individuals are coming in, but they have a greater carbon footprint, regardless of reductions such as modifications to energy emissions. It's been suggested that we also may be facing what would be considered eco-apartheid, where the rich are benefiting from these adaptations and improvements while others may be suffering. Some examples where we've seen this happening in terms of climate change and affecting BIPOC communities are, you know, the major events such as Hurricane Katrina or Sandy, in which BIPOC communities were much less able to evacuate and much less ready to recover thereafter. More recently, we've seen data on preterm birth from Rachel Hardiman in the School of Public Health that showed preterm birth is impacted by heat waves. That's not new information. But what she did show was that regardless of race, the highest impacted group is Black women who are college educated, which is interesting because rates of preterm birth are highest in lowest educated groups, regardless of race. So that shows that race is still an impacting factor and even further impacted by climate events such as this. As described by others, climate change shows increased rates of infectious disease spread. We've observed higher rates of COVID-19, higher rates of severe disease, and higher rates of death in BIPOC communities because of these same social determinants of health. There's even been an example like during a summer 2019 heat wave, a New York utility company cut power in a majority Black neighborhood just to avoid further blackouts. So we see these communities affected worse in that way. We know that historical and contemporary peripheral trauma in BIPOC communities, such as what we observed with George Floyd's murder, apply stress to individuals in these communities that impact health in a variety of ways. The same stress is amplified, and the stressors of what will happen to these communities will amplify these same peripheral traumas. As such, we must address climate change with our most vulnerable communities in mind and with knowledge of how these social determinants of health are impacting these communities otherwise. Thank you for giving me the time.
Thank you, Dr. McKinney. Next, I have Dr. Philip Peterson, and after him will be Dr. Christy Manning. So, Dr. Peterson, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay, well, thank you very much for inviting me to speak this morning. See if I can get my slides up here. Oh. There we go.
Let's see.
Okay, can you see those?
I cannot.
Okay, let's see, I guess. How's that?
Still not there. I believe all the slides were provided to committee members in advance.
Okay, well, then I'll run through it. I apologize. As you might guess, I'm over 75, so I'm not as swift as my younger colleagues with the technology. I'm an internist, infectious disease specialist, been on the faculty of the University of Minnesota Medical School for 43 years. And just as a quick aside, it's interesting that I didn't recognize climate change as the number one health problem in the world until 2015. And here we are having the first legislative session, evidently, on what is the number one health problem.
Just so you're aware, too, Dr. Peterson, it looks like our committee administrator has pulled up the slides on her screen. So if you want to just give her a direction to advance
sure,
the slides.
Thank you. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, now it's been known for quite some time by my colleagues in public health at the CDC and Minnesota Department of Health, they're terrific, that this is the number one health problem in the world. And from an infectious disease perspective, it's what we call vector-borne diseases. You've already heard about some of them, carried by mosquitoes and ticks that are critically important. Next slide. So there is some good news to climate change. If you're a tick or a mosquito. This is a field day for these vectors, and they carry, in the terms of ticks in Minnesota, we're most concerned about Lyme disease. And mosquitoes, it would be West Nile virus, which is the number one cause of encephalitis in our state and our country. Next slide. Now, why do pandemics, we'll get to the major topic in a minute, COVID-19, why do they occur? It's because of these interactions, as I'll point out, between animals, humans, travel, and environment. We are in the middle here. Our behavior and very commonly misbehavior fuel climate change. Next slide. So COVID-19, as you all aware now, just a little over a year old, caused by this novel coronavirus, and started in Wuhan, China. Just over 100 million cases, I think yesterday or day before, in the world, as you realize, and in America, 361,000 deaths. Next slide. Now, in terms of the issues that I mentioned, the interaction that we have with animals is critically important. And we believe in the case of the COVID-19, it's the wet markets, and in particular in Wuhan, where they have wild animals for sale for medical purposes, perceived medical purposes, and food, where highly likely a virus, SARS-CoV, jumped from a Chinese horseshoe bat into a human, spilled over, and precipitated this devastating pandemic. The animal that carries this, that is the secondary reservoir, is still not known, but pangolins were thought, at least at one time, to be the reservoir. And since they've been passed on to mink, and including in the community. Next slide. Well, again, the spread is astonishing, and that's the good news and bad news of technology. This is all because of planes, airplanes, that were able to carry. It's such a wonderful mechanism for carrying pathogens around the world. Next slide. Well, this is the most important slide, if you can remember this one. It's very clear to many of us, including myself now, that the next pandemic will be fueled for sure by climate change. So it's critically important, as my colleagues, Dr. Potter and others have mentioned, to keep this in mind. Next slide. The global is local. The only thing important for you to remember, I think, is this: you can't see a better example of global is local than COVID-19, and the next pandemic will also underscore this. Next slide. Now, we've heard about the social determinants of health. As we've thought more and more about it, the political determinants of health are really crucial. So it's wonderful we're having this session at the Minnesota Legislature, because we have to look to politicians for solutions, not to manifest or make the problem worse, but for solutions to this problem. So this is an incredibly important session that you're having today, and I thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Peterson. Next, we have Dr. Christy Manning, and after her will be Dr. Anthony Moulton. Dr. Manning, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Christy Manning, and I will share my screen. All right, does that work? Can you see it? Yay, okay, so then I just need to do the slideshow part. So I teach at McAllister College. I have a PhD in cognitive and biological psychology. My research, which I've been doing for the last 20 years, looks at how individuals perceive and respond to information about climate change. And I am here today to tell you about research conclusions on how climate change impacts Minnesotans' mental health and well-being. The research literature shows that there are three main pathways to how climate change impacts mental health specifically. And I'll note that all three are exacerbated by inequality. The first pathway, which is probably the one you've heard the most about, is through trauma from acute events, such as the extreme flood that happened in Jordan, Minnesota in 2019. There's also trauma from an extreme storm. All of these things are predicted to increase in Minnesota because of climate change. People who experience trauma through an event like this flood, especially if it happens to them more than once, show lingering mental health impacts such as PTSD, depression, long-term anxiety, substance abuse. The second pathway through which mental health impacts happen because of climate change is through the gradual changes of climate change, the increased heat, the longer phases of drought, worsening air quality, which has already been mentioned, and particularly significant for Minnesota, Minnesota's indigenous people, and the Minnesota economy is the loss of the usual snow cover and the loss of colder winters. Now, drought is particularly hard on rural areas and especially farmers. The research shows an uptick in farmer suicide in places that have been hardest hit by longer phases of drought, such as in India and Australia. And a note about increased heat, that is linked to higher levels of interpersonal aggression and violence, which also carries significant mental health impacts. So the third pathway is anxiety and uncertainty about the future, because people realize that we are facing a really grave problem, and they recognize that we are not adequately addressing the magnitude of climate change. I work with young people every day at college age, and I see and hear this anxiety in almost every interaction I have with them through environmental studies. And the research confirms this. A poll by the American Psychological Association found that 46% of young people are experiencing some level of what's called climate change anxiety, climate anxiety. So I want to leave you with a few of their sentiments in their own words, and I share these with their permission. The first person is Dio, who just graduated in December and is now living in Minneapolis. The second testimonial of three is Sasha, who hails from Madison, Wisconsin, will graduate in May and hopes to make the Twin Cities his permanent home. And finally, Evelyn, who will also graduate in May and who originally comes from Los Angeles. Thank you all for being here today, for holding this hearing. If you have any questions, I can always be reached via email. I'll stop sharing my screen now.
Thank you, Dr. Manning. Next, I have Dr. Tony Moulton, and after him will be Dr. Lalitha Surapaneni. So, Dr. Moulton, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, and good morning, everybody. Chair Freiberg and Chair Long, thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm going to shift a little bit of my focus away from some of the things that have been talked about that implicate mitigation of climate change. Mitigation, as you know, has the goal of trying to reduce the causes of climate change. Its companion is climate change adaptation, which attempts to reduce the negative impacts of climate change. And so I've been asked to just make a few comments about the extent to which our health system here in Minnesota is adapting to climate change health threats. And so I wanted to make some comments on that, and then I just want to offer a couple of thoughts about some options that legislators like yourselves might consider in this area. Pardon me. I moved to Minnesota about 3 years ago after a 20-year career at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. And before that, in a very different circumstance, I served as a state budget director for the state of Missouri. So I do have some state experience as well as federal experience. So this is the, let's stay on slide one for the time being. I'm sorry. I do want to distinguish between sort of two general types of climate change health threats. There are those that are abrupt, and we've been talking and learning about some of those over the last few minutes. And there are others that are emerging and more enduring. And Dr. Peterson in particular talked about some of those. So the abrupt climate change health threats are the ones, as Kristen Robb is describing, cause heat, extreme heat events, flooding, extreme precipitation, and so forth. This can increase, obviously, the demand and the need for health services, primarily from hospitals, from community health clinics, and from other sources as well. They also, however, and we've seen many examples of this, can disrupt the ability of hospitals and other providers to actually provide those services. There have been many extreme events like that in Houston, in New York City, in New Orleans, and elsewhere. The enduring climate change health threats can have those same consequences, but also are likely to cause, in my view at least, permanently higher levels of disease and disability and death on a long-term basis, and permanently higher demand for services. So this raises the question whether our healthcare system has the capacity in the future to deal with these rising demands for services. Is there the capacity to deal with that? Let's go to slide two if we can. And so this is sort of Tony's snapshot of public health in this context in the state of Minnesota. The public health sector, as we're talking about today, is comprised of the State Department of Health and city, county, and tribal health departments. We are very lucky in Minnesota to have the Climate and Health Program in the Department of Health, which is now about 10 years old. Kristen Robb is the director. She deserves a lot of congratulations. Their approach is to take a statewide and system-wide approach and understanding to the nature of these problems. They have developed a number of very practical tools that are in use right now by local health departments around the state. They have been very effective in conducting vulnerability assessments, meaning which regions, which areas in the state, and which populations of the state are most at risk. And they've been very successful at collaborating, excuse me, with other state and local agencies, particularly emergency management agencies. The Climate Health Program is about 10 years old now. It is one of 16 state health departments that are funded by CDC to conduct this kind of work, and it's recognized as a national leader in those 16 health departments. Next slide, please. In contrast to the relatively small public health sector in every state, not just in Minnesota, our health care sector, which offers therapeutic and curative care primarily, comprises, at last count, I think 130 hospitals. You see the numbers here, 17 community health centers, hundreds and hundreds of other organizations, some of them large in scope, some of them small in scope, some of them parts of large networks, some of them very isolated and so forth.
Dr. Moulton, I am going to have to ask you to kind of wrap it up pretty soon.
Okay, I can do it very quickly. So my impression is, and this is Tony's impression, if you will, is the main priority in adaptation in our healthcare sector is on emergency preparedness for what I was calling abrupt climate change health threats. There appears, and this needs more investigation, appears to be a little bit less focused on the longer term emerging climate change health threats. This, if true, this is a point of concern. And if I can go to the last slide, please. So here are some, I think, pretty obvious, but hopefully helpful thoughts about things that the committee and other members of the legislature might consider doing. One would be to consult with the health department itself and with your local public health and healthcare providers in your districts about the extent to which healthcare sector is capable and planning to be able to address these long-term impacts. The legislature itself could conduct an assessment of health system preparedness. And last, and not sure if this is the least or not, legislation is something that could be investigated. 3 years ago, former Representative David Bly introduced legislation, for example, that would have created a legislative health and resilience commission to develop a strategic plan to protect health in the state of Minnesota. So there's an example for that. Thank you very much. Sorry if I ran over.
Thank you, Dr. Moulton. Next, we have Dr. Lalitha Surapaneni, and after her will be Jade Drake Hamilton for our final speaker.
Thank you so much, Chair Freiberg, Chair Long, and committee members. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to testify today. My name is Lalitha Surapaneni. I am an assistant professor in general internal medicine and a practicing physician. I'm also a member of Health Professionals for a Healthy Climate, and I'm testifying today in my personal capacity. You all should have received the Lancet Countdown 2020 U.S. Policy Brief. I'll be referencing Figure 2 on page 5. As Dr. Potter mentioned, this is a national key report on climate and health with the latest evidence and recommendations for policymakers. It is so sobering to hear how Minnesotans are already facing the health impacts of the damage that we're doing to our climate. Now, of course, reducing emissions from various sectors will prevent these health impacts from getting worse. What I want to testify about today is the many short and long-term benefits to our health that we get with climate action in three top sectors, so transportation, ag, and electricity. Let's start with the transportation sector. I don't have to convince anyone that exercise is good for our health, but most U.S. adults don't get their daily level of physical activity. Now, if we redesign our transportation system with a focus on people instead of cars, you know, promote biking and walking or what we call active transportation, that will improve people's physical and mental health. If we get people out of cars, expand public transit, and electrify personal vehicles, we're also going to reduce tailpipe air pollution and have cleaner air. So these measures will have immediate and long-term benefits for our health, especially in environmental justice communities that already have poor air quality right now. And we also reduce our emissions in the process. If we look at the ag sector, the current way we produce food and dispose of our food waste is unsustainable and harmful to our health. For example, feedlot operations and nitrogen fertilizer that we use in our farms is a major source of air pollution. And you can see on that figure that 12,000 premature deaths were linked to emissions from ag sector in 2018. We also know how big of a problem nightway runoff in Minnesota is that leads to water pollution. And heavy pesticide use, you know, is linked to various health problems in farmers and consumers. Now, if your policies promote sustainable agricultural practices like cover crops, soil management, methane capture, we get healthier food, clean water, and clean air. And of course, it has the co-benefits of, you know, reducing carbon emissions as well. Finally, for the electricity sector, so burning things, whether that's coal, natural gas, oil, you know, biofuels, trash for incineration, burning things to generate energy is bad for our health. In that figure 2 on page 5 of the report in 2018, electricity sector led to 6,000 premature deaths from air pollution. Coal power plants remain a major cause of air pollution. We know that chemicals in the natural gas fracking fluid have been linked to heart defects in babies. So if we implement policies to improve energy efficiency and move to cleaner renewable energy, you will save lives and have the co-benefit of limiting damage to our climate. it. So as you can see, even if we designed all of these policies just with the health and equity in mind, we give our communities clean air, clean water, healthy food, and these policies would ultimately benefit our planet. Chair Freiberg, Chair Long, and committee members, action on climate is a common sense public health measure. As legislators, you can impact the health of not just Minnesotans today, but of generations to come. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Surapaneni. Our final speaker is J. Drake Hamilton. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Freiberg and Chair Long. My name is J. Drake Hamilton. I'm the Science Policy Director at Fresh Energy. We shape bold climate policies to achieve equitable carbon neutral economies. I'm going to change the topic slightly to tell you about one of these bold climate policies. The outgoing president in December signed into law the most significant climate policy passed in our country since 2009, 12 years ago. The law requires companies to cut their production and use of super pollutants called hydrofluorocarbons. They're also known by the abbreviation HFCs. These are powerful greenhouse gases used in refrigeration and air conditioning. By federal law, now they must be cut by 2036 to only 15% of 2012 levels, an 85% reduction. Here in Minnesota, phasing down these HFCs has been of great importance to the climate change subcabinet. This federal legislation to phase down HFCs had bipartisan support. It was introduced by Republican Senator Kennedy of Louisiana and Democratic Senator Harper of Delaware. The bipartisan HFC regulations enjoyed broad support from both industry stakeholders and the environmental community. The bill was supported by the Air Conditioning, Heating, and Refrigeration Institute, and remarkably, by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. In Minnesota.
You seem to have muted yourself just a few seconds ago. Yeah, it's happened again.
Stand to lose. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Consumers do not stand to lose from an HFC phase down. That is because products containing climate-friendly alternatives to these HFCs are already widely available, all of them made in the United States. These alternatives are cheaper than the HFCs. The alternatives are often more energy efficient than the HFCs they will replace. But get this, pound for pound, HFCs have hundreds or thousands of times the heat trapping capacity of carbon dioxide. HFCs are short-lived. Once in the atmosphere, they decompose within a couple of decades. Therefore, reducing their emissions.
Happened again. Sorry, you're muted.
Sorry. And the benefits, including benefits to Minnesotans' health, will materialize in the near future. The release this month of the MPCA's greenhouse gas report made it clear that Minnesota is not on track to meet our climate goals. Phasing down HFC use will avoid globally almost 1 degree Fahrenheit of climate change. This will greatly help the U.S. and the world meet the goal of limiting climate change to no more than 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. We estimate that the global phase down now in progress will be the equivalent to knocking out the entire planet's carbon emissions for more than 2 years. Minnesota's 2016 HFC emissions were coming in at almost 2.8 million tons per year. Phasing HFCs down, which is now going on in Minnesota and in the whole country. will accrue Minnesota benefits of $48 million by 2025 and nearly $77 million in 2030. Most of those benefits will be health benefits to Minnesotans. So this new bipartisan American climate law will cut off the rampant growth of HFCs and replace them with a new generation of alternative chemicals and products that use less energy, produce less pollution, and are more affordable. It is a win for human health. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. So that was our final testifier. Appreciate the effort, particularly of the staff of the Climate and Energy Committee. I know who put some effort into assembling this great list of testifiers. So thank you to them. We will turn now to member questions. At this point, I have four members on the list, Representatives Pryor, Grunhagen, Morrison, and Egbaje. So Representative Pryor, you put your hand up first.
Right. I got it. thank you, Chair Freiberg. First of all, I had to, this wasn't why I raised my hands, but I do have to make that comment that thank you, Dr. Hamilton, for that great news, which is just very, very inspiring that we hear about the crisis, but to know that already an action has been taken bipartisanly that worked. I think that's, something that we can build off of when we recognize the problem, we acknowledge the problem, we can actually come up with solutions together that really impact the problem. And as, we are the health committee, the benefits that kind of leading up to that of when we improve our air quality, when we slow down the rate of climate change, we have tremendous health benefits in Minnesota, in the United States, and across the globe. So nice to end with such a positive note. And now I want to go back to things that aren't positive. I'm sure I could be asking a lot of questions as we go through this, just for more clarification and a deeper understanding. But I want to go back to, where's my notes here? Dr. McKinney. If he's still able to rejoin us for a question. And it was, I'm on the Early Childhood Committee, and we do talk about the disparities in premature births and infant mortality. And to hear how this is linked to the links to the changing climate, especially in our BIPOC communities. So if you could, again, talk a little bit about what those are, especially as someone that's very concerned and has this priority for early childhood, and just to expand on that a little bit, I would appreciate it. Thank you much.
Dr. McKinney.
Yes, thank you. Just to clarify, I'm not an expert in maternal child health as much as in environmental health, but the research I was citing is, and this isn't the only research suggesting this, is that preterm birth rates are increased with the exposure to heat waves. And so as a function of heat waves becoming more common with more extreme climate change, we may see greater rates of these happening as a function of that. We already see greater rates of preterm birth in communities of color. And I was just saying there was actually a study from 2020 done by Dr. Rachel Hardiman from the School of Public Health here showing that impact was actually greater specifically on Black mothers related to this exposure to heat.
Representative Pryor? Okay, thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the testifiers too. We all want clean air and clean water. I have yet to run into a person who doesn't. But I do think I'd like to make a few statements, and any testifiers who want to push back are welcome to do that. Most of my statements come from a book written by three eminently qualified and emeritus scientists. It's called Why Scientists Disagree on Global Warming. My secretary will take that. The book oh, what was I going to say? The anyway, I'll make a few references from there. For first, they bring out that there was a petition in the 90s signed by over 30,000 scientists, including 9,000 PhDs, that the theory of global warming is wrong, and that an increase in CO2 for our planet is actually a good thing, and there's normal fluctuations. They also bring out that from 2010 to 2013, global warming research was subsidized by the Obama administration to the tune of $64 billion. Now, what that means is, I think they bring out, it can have a corrupting influence on science when money is given to science by government to come up with certain conclusions to fit a political narrative. Also, in terms of the flooding, I have a city, Henderson, in my community that floods regularly, and it's getting worse and worse and worse. They don't blame global warming or climate change. They blame pattern tiling and the tiling of our wetlands by farmers for that. And in fact, the federal government, especially in the 60s and 70s, subsidized the draining of all this, of all these wetlands up to 70%. And so they have a big reason why we're seeing this flooding. Also, as far as the California fires, climate change has been based on that. Well, I happen to live out in California, Marine Corps for 2 years. They used to bulldoze fire breaks in dry areas, which I was in Camp Pendleton. And when there was a fire, it stopped. I've talked to people out in California, acquaintances, they don't do that anymore. The result is it's poor management of the brushland and the forest. And that's why you have the fires out of control, okay? Also, I'd like to address the low income disparities on healthcare. A lot of it has to do with the low reimbursement rates on Medicaid that many minorities are on. And what happens, healthcare institutions lose money on every deal and they're trying to make it up in volume. And some of them don't even want to accept that anymore because the government programs reimburse so low. So you're blaming this on climate change, and I want to help these people. I spent 13 years in jail ministry trying to help minorities and other people change the way they're living and to become part of the middle class. But that's the problem more than climate change. Now, if this was the Dust Bowl years in the 30s, which were the warmest years in the 20th century, you probably could halfway convince me, okay? But we have normal fluctuations in the atmosphere. That's why they changed the name from global warming to climate change, because the science didn't fit it anymore. Finally, all we've done in most cases is drive up the cost of electricity and done little for nothing for the actual climate. If anybody responds, I would appreciate if their paycheck comes from a tax-subsidized institution when they respond to any of my comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. I know there's some... You know, I know this book's been referenced in other committees as well, and I know, you know, there's kind of an implication that the climate science is subsidized. From what I understand, the authors of this book had a vested interest in the fossil fuel industry as well. But I'm not an expert in climate science. It might be better to turn over to one of the testifiers.
Hey, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I have 150 copies, so if one of the testifiers wants a copy, I've purchased 150 copies. I'm more than happy to send it to them.
Appreciate that offer, Representative Grunhagen. Ms. Hamilton, I don't know what you might. I'm thinking you might be a good person to respond to this, or if you think there's one of the other testifiers might be better, feel free to mention that.
I'd like to call on Dr. Lisa, please.
Sure, Dr. Stuart Panini.
Yeah, I'm just trying to, you know, come up with there were so many points, and you know, I'm just trying to think of a couple of them that I could address. The last one, you know, where you were saying that global warming was changed to climate change. That was actually, there's some research done by Frank Luntz, a Republican advisor, who I think that after some focus grouping, they thought that it was actually easier to, it sounded less scary to use the word climate change instead of global warming. And unfortunately, there has been a very concerted misinformation campaign for a lot of years. And so I do have to push back and say that, you know, over 97% of scientists who work in the area of climate and related fields agree that our climate change is, the way it's happening now is accelerated. And even though we've always had changes in our climate, they have been supercharged. You know, one way I try to think about it is always kind of like equated to human body. So, you know, when you have your temperature changes every day from day to night, whereas when you have a fever, that temperature is out of range. So that's how I try to envision the way the climate is changing now, is through human caused means, and that is an abnormal change. And I like to point out that there was, you know, a book called Merchants of Doubt, which does lay out a lot of the criticisms around, you know, how the concerted misinformation campaign has happened. You know, one of my colleagues had also said to me that, you know, if 97 of 100 doctors tell you that your child is sick, would you listen to them, or would you listen to the three that say that there is no problem here? And there's many resources out there, for example, Global Weirding, you know, that explains by climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe, that does explain many of these concerns. I don't think it's a problem. I don't think we need to, you know, not hear or think about these things, but this is a debate that's been going on for a very long time, and the science is settled. I guess I'm just still trying to think of the many points and trying to address some of those, but I'll turn it over to my colleagues here.
Thank you, Dr. Serpinani. Representative Grunhagen, we do have a few more.
You are the lead. I'll wrap it up. Hey, I appreciate her testimony, but the 97% is also exposed for the type of lie and fraud it is. It was done by a college student on a short survey. The 97% is a fraud and lie. Now, I'm not calling her a fraud and a lie. She seems like a nice young lady, okay? But she's simply repeating frauds and lies that she's been indoctrinated with. I'll get you a copy of the book, all the testifiers, especially the young lady. Email me your address, and I'll mail you a copy free of charge. Thank you.
Dr. Potter, I see you raising your hand. I'll give you an opportunity to comment here.
Thank you, Chair Freeberg. I just want to draw attention to a resource, which is our national NASA, which addresses the concerns about inadequate science. So there's plenty of wonderful literature here that's recent and up to date, and it's beneficial for all of us to know about. Thank you.
Thank you. And Dr. McKinney, I think you might have raised your hand as well.
Yes, just to emphasize the scientific perspective of Dr. Serpinini and Dr. Potter there, I would agree with everything that's been said already, but just to simplify the nomenclature for the rest of this group. So one issue with the phraseology global warming was that it maybe for the general public did not capture the fact that climate change represents a variation in geographic weather patterns that aren't just necessarily warming, but rather are more extreme climate events, both cold, both hot, wet, dry, etc. I, in the spirit of also not scaring people, I don't think I would encourage the phrase climate extremism. So climate change was a more simple way to describe that. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your measured responses. I generally, you know, I do think that the science on this is settled, and I don't think it's helpful to use terms like indoctrination and extremism as a general rule. So I'll have a few other members on the list. Dr. Morrison. Representative Morrison. Dr. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. Very grateful to you and to Chair Long for bringing this important intersection of climate and health together, and to all the experts who testified today. Thank you for being here. You really can't talk about climate change without talking about its impacts on public health and human health. I'm very concerned that in the state of Minnesota, we are poised to embark on three large projects that directly contradict efforts to slow climate change, particularly here in Minnesota, the fastest warming state in the United States. Enbridge Line 3, Glencore Polymet, and Antofagasta Twin Metals will all accelerate greenhouse gas emissions in our state. These don't even really represent status quo. These represent significant steps backwards at a time when we need to be aggressively moving toward reducing emissions. And I'm just wondering if any of the expert testifiers care to comment on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. I'm looking to see if anyone's raising their hand. That seemed to work before. Dr. Surapaneni.
Thank you, Representative Morrison, for bringing that up. Especially, I agree with you that, you know, with the line three, the carbon footprint is a maximum of 273 million tons, which is, as has been said many times, equivalent to 50 coal power plants. So that not only does it have huge climate impacts, but it also impacts water and land and sovereignty of our native communities. This is a time where we should be moving to cleaner energy, and I agree with you, and thank you for bringing that up.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative Morrison? Looks like you're satisfied.
No, thank you. Thank you, Doctor.
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to all the testifiers. You know, your comments today really just show how climate affects health, our infrastructure, and of course, racial equity. One thing that I heard that came up a lot in various people's testimony that I especially wanted to highlight is this intersection with access to healthy, nutritious food. So part of the community that I represent is sometimes faces challenges with access to healthy, nutritious food, and many people have been focusing on building up community gardens to, you know, keep that resiliency there. And so I was wondering if either Dr. Surapaneni or Dr. McKinney could comment more on, you know, why our food is now less nutritious because of climate and, you know, things that we could be doing to continue to make sure that we do still have that healthy and resilient resource for everyone across the state of Minnesota.
Dr. Surapaneni, did you...
I'll let Dr. McKinney jump in here.
Dr. McKinney.
Yes, again, just to reiterate that I'm a practicing physician and not a soil scientist, but certainly there is increasing amounts of data suggesting that our industrialization of farming practices has resulted in a much greater carbon footprint than, for example, doing, you know, more sort of renewable processes such as sort of cycling between different areas of land, et cetera, which actually has demonstrated that we can result in better carbon sequestration. In addition, with some of the industrialization of our food processes, you know, for example, here in the United States, corn has been part of the U.S. Farm Bill for, you know, as long as I can remember. And so, for example, many of our food products that are produced have contained high fructose corn syrup, which is in contrast to much of the rest of the world where most products, even including, you know, sugary beverages, have, for example, cane sugar. As a function of all this, with these industrialized processes, it, you know, processed food ends up being cheaper and more available to people than, for example, more freshly grown food, which tends to be more expensive and harder to produce. And so in that regard, some of the points that you made, for example, about community gardens really speaks to the necessity of bringing access to more healthy food to the communities that have the least access to it. You know, there's a relatively antiquated concept at this time of what they used to call food deserts. That is to say, areas that tend to be more underrepresented in terms of access to services, access to, you know, housing, food, transportation, et cetera, all have, you know, again, worse access to good food, good stores that have it, and aside from which, this food is more expensive. So I think that addresses some of those points. I hope I did it in a reasonable fashion. Thank you.
Sure. Dr. Manning, I see you have your hand up as well.
Thank you. I just wanted to add from the mental health standpoint that the community level solutions and especially getting young people involved in addressing climate change within their community and working with other people to see real results, there it's sort of the magical place where it alleviates some mitigates some of the anxiety that people feel, and it actually has measurable results on climate impacts. So bravo to you for bringing this up and thinking about community level solutions like community gardens. So thank you.
Dr. Stuart Panini, I see you have your hand raised there as well.
Yeah, I also just wanted to add that, you know, transporting food is a huge part of the food chain that contributes to emissions. And as we had mentioned earlier, just the pandemic has shown us how supply chains are so fragile and subject to, you know, events that may be happening at other places. And so having that local community food not only is going to impact that very, you know, carbon emissions and the food transport chain, but it will also can be rooted in tradition and culture and help mental health of communities as well.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Representative Agbaje, did you have a follow-up?
No, thank you so much.
Thank you. Representative Akam and then Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to all of our speakers today. I really appreciated a lot of the testimony that was provided and the examples demonstrating that climate change amplifies extreme weather events and health impacts, and that there are co-benefits in trying to mitigate or reduce those. And so when we often talk about the impacts of climate change, we look at things like increasing temperature or rain events. And I think that there's a piece to that that often isn't talked about, but is also very important, and that's the cost of climate change to our communities. And so wondering if, as we look at the health impacts and maybe from your different disciplines, if you can in any way show that there, if we can make the economic argument about why we need to be addressing climate change, and then it can help. We all know the incredibly rising healthcare costs. And so do you have any information, or is there any work that's being done that is looking at the costs of climate change on our healthcare systems?
Ms. Robb, were you raising your hand there?
Yes, thank you, Chair Freiberg. I just wanted to mention that the Minnesota Department of Health did do a study on climate extremes in temperatures, and also related that with health events within hospitals and derived the costs of that. And I don't remember the numbers at the tip of my head, but I will be happy to send you that article. Plus, I just wanted to mention there have been studies that have been done around the United States about the costs of several major climate-related events, and these are very, very costly events, and I'll be happy to forward that information on to you as well.
Sorry, Dr. Spears, I saw you raise your hand there.
Well, I was just going to add, you know, as somebody who again, doesn't study this, but I practice medicine, the cost of chronic illness is overwhelming our system. I mean, this is it's crippling. And what is hard about measuring the health and the health costs of climate change is these things are insidious. It's additive. And so saying that somebody's heart disease is because of the chronic stress or the exposures that they had over the course of 20 years, it's very, very difficult, even in a discipline like cardiology, which is extremely well studied. It's very difficult to say that this is the particular cause. This was the root cause. But clearly, these additive effects have just astronomical costs, just monetary costs, not social costs. That would be in addition from climate change.
Thank you, Dr. Spears. Representative Acom, did you have any follow-up?
No, that's great. Thank you.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to chime in just quickly. Had a couple of comments and then maybe a question. I think that the conversation that we're having today can be very positive. I think that it's important to look at all aspects of issues relative to climate change, human health, and the tactics that may or may not bring the desired results that we would all hope for. I do take issue, however, with some of the comments being made when there is a difference of opinion, Mr. Chair. I think that it might be helpful for anyone who has an established worldview on any given issue, but even this particular one, to Google when science got it wrong. Science has been wrong through the years. It's been getting better as time has gone on. And I know on a personal level, I've been challenged today as I'm trying to do the best I can to research some of the statements being made and try to confirm the validity of those things. It's not easy because there is differing opinions, and there are many unfortunate examples of when, as it relates to climate or otherwise, there have been changes in what we thought was established science through the years. And we could go through those, and I could list them on and on and on, because there was quite a few that I was able to read briefly as I was looking just moments ago. But over the past few years, I've read some of the comments from experts that Glenn has mentioned. And then I've also read some of the opinions from numerous others to disagree. But I hope that when there's a difference of opinion that is voiced in this committee, Mr. Chair, that's something that is respected and appreciated, because there's certainly examples of times when science has got it wrong. But I think that together, people on each side of the debate talk these things through, and we are careful to try to find where the best opportunities are, where the cost-benefit analysis is most productive, that we take advantage of that opportunity, that low-hanging fruit, and make change that can really have a positive impact on the climate or human health. And in the end, we're talking about trying to take care of people, right? I mean, whether it's clean water, clean air, or healthy food. And, you know, when those conversations are positive and we're trying to really work with agriculture and with government and with business all together, I think that's when we can really make some positive steps. And so, you know, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make those comments. And then if any of the folks that are here today testifying would like to respond, that's fine. I know we're running out of time, Mr. Chair, so I probably will hold back on my question and talk to some folks offline. But I wanted to make those comments, and then also thank you again, Mr. Chair, for this conversation. I think that even though there are certainly differences of opinion, I think it's very healthy.
Thank you, Representative Heintzman. Yeah, you are correct. We are running low on time, and I don't have any other members on the list. I do want to mention one thing before we conclude. So we pulled together a list of very well-respected people within their fields, very well-credentialed. There was a comment made during this in reference to one of them. I was a little preoccupied with managing the committee at the time, and I didn't actually catch it. But I do want to draw attention to it now. I don't believe it's appropriate to refer to testifiers, to adults, using terms like young ladies, particularly when they are experienced medical professionals. So I apologize to our testifiers for that. As I said, I was kind of preoccupied with some committee management issues at that point, but I did want to mention that. I really appreciate all of you being here. Appreciate the expertise in your field, and apologize for that reference. So on behalf of the committee, I apologize anyway. So I really appreciate your expertise and your taking the time to share it with us. This is a critical issue facing our community. It is, in my mind, one of the greatest public health challenges of the time. And so I really appreciate you being here. I imagine we will, as we get more bills referred to this committee, it's something we will be discussing in a legislative context. So it's extremely helpful to have the background that you have provided here. So once again, thank you for sharing your expertise. Next, we will be meeting at our regular time next week. We'll be talking about childhood vaccines, and we will have some testimony from experts there as well. It's possible a bill might get added to the agenda, but that remains to be seen, and you will be given ample notice in advance. So with that, not seeing any additional comments, is there do any members have any questions or anything about the schedule for next week or thereabouts?
Well, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.